Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. I'm Ron, and my partner in these interviews is Dave. To help you fully appreciate the interview we're bringing you today, I have to bring you back to the 1985 World Service Conference. It was my first conference after having participated at the local level in car workshops for the last few years, including the year the basic text was approved, and the years immediately after that, which saw dramatic events, such as the controversy over changes to the basic text after it had been approved by the conference, the removal of Jimmy Kay as manager of the office, and the hiring by the conference of a non-addict named Bob Stone in his place. I had followed all these events as closely as I could in those days before the sort of rapid communication later made possible by technology. I had some kind of feel from a distance of many of the personalities involved at the time, and by the time I sat in that first conference at the Airtel Plaza Hotel in Van Nuys, I had met many of them, particularly those from Southern California. But as the conference got underway, several new and interesting characters emerged. One was a colorful, even flamboyant, college English professor, a PhD wearing a suit and bow tie, consistently addressing the conference with quite a flourish. I had been an English major in a small university in the Midwest when I found recovery, just in time to salvage my school life and ultimately my degree in those first few years of recovery. The only time I had ever met someone like this character was when I met my college professors. The man was John F. from Philadelphia. Over the next several years, I got to know him well, collaborated with him on several writing or editing tasks for World Services, and always appreciated what he brought to the mix. John and Dave have known each other for over 40 years as members of the Fellowship in Philadelphia, though John has since moved to New York City. We decided to interview John to get him talking about everything from his early recovery in the 70s in Philly to his bird's-eye view of the goings-on at NA World Services, starting in the Jimmy Kay period and extending through the 80s. So let's start it off with some questioning from Dave.
John, I'm interested, as I am with everybody who comes on, where did you first encounter the NA message?
Well, I tell people that I got clean on February 13th, 1975, and that is absolutely accurate using NA language, but the reality is that I was a graduate student at the University of Delaware. It was the beginning of my second semester as a PhD student. I was in a low state emotionally and psychologically. I was bombing out of the graduate program. And ironically, I think this is true of a lot of people, that my so-called bottom was nowhere near as miserable or as spectacular as previous times. I mean, 72, 73 was the year that I really was getting into trouble, you know, with criminal activity, lots and lots and different kind of drugs and irresponsible, spectacular, addictive behavior. 74, 75 was just, you know, this tedium of misery and suicidal thoughts and isolation and loneliness. It was all internal. On the outside, I was sort of functioning, except I wasn't. I was going to class, but I wasn't doing my papers or anything like that. So my first semester, I didn't have any grades. They were all incompletes. So I met someone, a gay guy from AA, who never took me to a meeting, directed me toward a meeting. So I went to AA, and I didn't have, no one had to tell me that this was a program of complete abstinence. I mean, I knew that for myself from the very beginning. And AA sort of made sense because since I was new in a new town that I hadn't made all that many connections. And so I was drinking most of the time. But very quickly, within a month, at this AA meeting, I met a guy named Ray T, who was one of the founders of NA in Philadelphia. And he had just moved to Newark, Delaware. He and I are the same age, which was 27 at the time. And so I went over to chat with him after the meeting, and I said, well, wasn't this a splendid meeting? And David, you know Ray. Ray said, oh, I thought it sucked. I hate AA. And I said, oh. And he went on to explain that he belonged to NA, which I'd never heard of. But I was interested. The way he explained it made me feel that this was something that I wanted to, at the very least, try. So Ray and I started going to NA meetings regularly. And what that meant was that, oh, I don't know, there were a half dozen meetings in the Delaware Valley. And for those of you who are listening, you know, that's a spread of about 50 miles from beginning to end, from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, down through Delaware, the state of. And so there are about, there are maybe a half dozen meetings. There was one in Westchester, and there was one in more than one, but there was one in particular in Northeast Philadelphia, which Ray regarded as his home group. And those were the two that we went to. There was a meeting, absolutely horrible meeting, in Wilmington that was started by two well-meaning AA types who wanted to help the kids. And it met in an AA clubhouse. And someone came up and took our basket at the end of the meeting. And Ray and I went to that, and he told them this wasn't an NA meeting. And the AA benefactors got all upset. So what we eventually did, Ray, myself, a woman named Maggie O, who later on became World Literature Chair in the mid-80s, and her then husband, whose name was also Ray, that we started the first meeting in Delaware, which still exists, and that was called the Delaware Step Meeting, which is an interesting phenomenon since we had no literature. But, you know, let me phrase this correctly. It is true in the early days that we had no literature, and that was probably an inhibition to our growing, particularly in having people read about us, and it's something that made us tangible. But the idea that we couldn't work the steps just because we had no literature, that's nonsense. You know, we had step meetings, and that worked quite well.
How does a step meeting run without literature? And how does a sponsor help a sponsee with the steps without literature?
Well, a lot of talking. We would look to the AA 12 and 12, which was, I got to tell you, very unsatisfactory. I remember some of the passages that we found absolutely irrelevant to our experience. It was about staying sober during World War II. there were parts that were offensive. It actually uses the word queer.
Well, that's true.
That's true. Yes.
Having queer ideas are fun, but it is.
No. When the queer came to a meeting and they wanted to throw them out. So that's in one of their traditions. We try to change the words?
Well, so part of it is you used AA literature such as it was for you. But I mean, I was thinking, and you said lots of talking. I was thinking about my own experience with that. I was concerned when the basic text came out that some of what I had come to experience as the degree of creativity involved in working the steps in NA in the absence of literature and this face-to-face creative dialogue that we would engage in. I was a little concerned that we were going to end up more formulaic.
You know, okay, so I know exactly what you're talking about. So let me be clearer. We use the 12 and 12, the AA book, almost as a foil. For a long time, we would read it at the beginning of a meeting and then talk about what was relevant and what wasn't. We were in a way, but very clearly talking about how to shape the steps to work for us. We didn't regard this as sacrosanct, as a Bible, as sacred scripture, holy writ, and we're perfectly willing to criticize it and talk about how we would change it. And so that worked. Now, sponsorship then, and as it still is in some places, is about talking and making yourself spiritually prepared. The idea of writing the steps is a later phenomenon. And I'll be honest with you, I am still not entirely sold on the idea of writing the steps. You know, I spent 40 years teaching, and to be honest with you, I didn't retire so I could start grading essays again. A lot of this step work is, to me, essay grading. I tell people if they use the four-step guide to do their fourth step, say, well, call me in about 8 years when you're finished. And yet the fourth is one of the few that we actually talk about. You know, the tradition is to write. I don't think you have to write forever to have a spiritual experience. You may want to write to describe it, but that's different. I think that what happened is that someone took an Ira Progoff workshop. Do you know who Ira Progoff is?
I've heard the name, but no, I couldn't place it.
Interesting guy.
Thanks for answering for me, Ron. I didn't know. I don't know.
Ira Progoff was, I mean, he is a blessed memory, was a psychologist who developed an approach to somewhere in between the practice of psychology and self-help. You know, it was his self-help program, but best thing to do was to consult him on how to do it. You know, some very sound ideas. He started this whole idea of journal writing. And during the 60s and 70s, people used to go to Progoff workshops. They were, you know, weekend-long retreats that gave you guidance on how to keep a journal in such a way that it would help you psychologically. And so there's some soundness there. My objection to the writing phenomenon is that it's become one of these lockstep things. People now don't say, have you worked the steps? They say, have you written the steps? Have you written the steps with an NA sponsor? That's the new question. If you want a service position at the region, they interview you and someone's going to ask you, have you written the steps with an NA sponsor? Who has an NA sponsor?
Who goes to meetings?
Oh, yes.
that little asterisk. Well, I would say something similar about the step working guides that I said about the basic text, only more so that, you know, the stuff you're saying about writing the steps as a way of working the steps versus not so much writing. Any step work, I think, involves writing in the fourth step and in the eighth step. Some people equate the writing with the step work, and that has always been a great concern to me, that the step work occurs in the texture of my life and in the decisions that I make, and each step has a verb, and that verb is not right in almost any of them, and I mean in any of them. So, yeah, I'm with you on that, and then had to kind of adapt as things changed.
Yeah, you put your finger on what I was trying to say, and that is that people have begun to equate the writing with actually doing the step. And, oh, I wrote 74 pages. I must be finished.
I'm glad I'm not your sponsor is all I would say to that.
Yeah. I think that some sponsors are a little too directive, but that's another area.
There's one other subject, your career change. I guess you were an English professor when I knew you, and you eventually decided on a career change. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's okay. Let's start at the beginning. Well, 74, I was 26 years old, and I had just started the PhD program at the University of Delaware. The beginning of the following year, right after my 27th birthday, I got clean. In 81, got my PhD, and it proved to be a double major PhD in literature and linguistics. So I began an academic career, and I got a job as an assistant professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia. But parallel to that, in my first few years, the idea of developing a spiritual life was quite strong in me. And that happened. Funnily enough, it happened through literature, through reading people like poets like Walt Whitman, who promulgates a kind of universality. I am you and you are me. I am the cosmos. That was very appealing. And so are poets like John Donne, who also speaks to unities. Do not ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. No man is an island. So that brought me to the idea of finding a community of shared spiritual values. And that brought me back to church. So by the early 80s, now 5-7 years clean, I was a good Episcopalian, going to church regularly, being involved in church, and feeling quite at home. I also began to connect my spiritual life in the Episcopal Church with my recovery. I don't say this in meetings, but I think one of the reasons why I've been clean, next month will be 41 years, why I've been clean that long is a regular attendance at the Sacrament of Holy Communion. So I think that that's a way of God's grace for me. So I took all this seriously, and I also came to believe that the noblest life that a person can live, or the noblest life that I can live, is a life of service. I'm a single gay man with a high discretionary income, and I don't have a family to divert my attention. So in order to be a good person, I need to serve others. Yes, the program gives you many opportunities to do that. Yes, the teaching profession gives you many opportunities to do that. But I wanted something more, and so I felt the call to become a priest in the Episcopal Church. And that was a very interesting adventure. At the beginning, you know, this happens around 85, and I begin the application process for the priesthood, which is quite stringent. And this is in the state of Delaware, which is, compared to other states, is a small town. And so even if I had wanted to, there was absolutely no way to conceal the fact that I was gay. And that became an issue. But, you know, the bishop liked me, and And so I was approved for the ordination track. I went back to school. I actually went to the Yale Divinity School. So I'm a Yale graduate now. So I was ordained in 1991. So it'll be 25 years this June.
Okay.
I wanted to get back to my experience with the Delaware STET meeting.
Okay.
This is interesting. That as time went on, first we tried to change, take the 12 and 12 and change the words, you know, alcoholic to addict, etc. And that was of limited value. So Ray and I tried to rewrite the whole damn thing, which was an interesting experience. I wish I still had that book with all our emendations and inserts. It must exist in some landfill. But in 1980, word came down from on high that the World Service Conference, which was a pretty new thing in which Philadelphia had never participated until 81 when George R. went out as our first RSR. The word came down that we were no longer to use AA literature at NA meetings.
Do you remember how that word came down? Who was communicating that and how it was communicated?
It came down thusly. It was communicated to us through the Mid-Atlantic region. And I used to attend the Mid-Atlantic region, but I can't recall whether it was me who brought the news. In any case, my group took it seriously because it was proposed in the Philadelphia area that to make up for this deficiency, that every group or groups who would volunteer would be assigned a step, and that group would write an essay about that step. And then we put them together, and then we would use that as our step literature.
Hmm.
The only group that actually did that was the Delaware STET meeting. We were given the eighth step, and I wrote the essay. And then Ray and Maggie proofread it. Well, we sat around the table in my apartment, and we went over what I had written, and, you know, we tweaked and polished and edited it, and then sent it in and never heard about it. Until 1983, I'm reading my red first edition of the basic text, signed by Jimmy Kay himself, who got the date wrong, and lo and behold, there was the eighth step, lock, stock, and barrel, as I had written it.
Mm. So somebody submitted your writing as input to the basic text during the... Were you involved at all in any of the workshops in writing the basic text?
Only the one that met outside Philadelphia in Bucks County.
Oh, there was one there.
I forget what town it was in.
But there was some kind of a workshop during the writing of the basic text held there that you... Attended.
Yes, it was to go over the stories. So there they were in Pennsylvania in this horribly cold weekend. I remember something like 5 degrees, this frigid weekend. And they didn't have a chair. And at the time they were... operating under the NA tree, and there was no provision to cover this situation. And so they were at the time, this is where I missed a great opportunity, at the time they were putting together the stories. So, you know, the text part was done, and they were dealing with stories and, you know, the great anguish about whether they should be edited or not, and those kinds of questions that amateurs always have about editing. I said, "Where are the gay stories?" And, "Oh, well, gee, well, why don't you write one?" and I meant to and never did. And so there you go. I'm just having my story in the basic text because I procrastinated.
So that would have been, since the basic text was approved in 82.
Early 82. And there must have been near completion because the gray edition, when did that come out?
Well, the gray form would have been a couple of years earlier, or at least a full year earlier. And then it was that white. It almost looked like a like the little white book.
Only I remember, yes, with the blue lettering.
Yeah.
Okay, because, right, the gray edition didn't have the stories.
That's right. And the gray edition was a review draft. And so it was still subject to input and change. And the approval draft was a white, kind of styled like the little white book, only bigger. And then I think the one with the blue lettering that you're referring to was the stories. So you were workshopping the stories portion of it at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us about your first experiences with the World Service Conference and when that was?
Then, let me get my dates right. I'm mildly dyslexic. And so I get numbers wrong. I tell people I am literate, not numerate. I get dates wrong all the time.
okay, so we'll so stipulate, and we got three minds here if we can.
Okay, that it's 82. There is no Philadelphia region. We are part of the Mid-Atlantic region, which is now getting smaller because people are forming their own regions. You know, there's Boston, there's New England region now, there's a Virginia region, so there's a Chesapeake, Potomac. So things are getting smaller. And Larry N is elected the RSR in 1982. Larry was elected RSR, and I was elected RSR alternate. And Dutch H also came out with us at his own expense. Well, actually, I went out at my own expense as well. The idea of being paid for service was anathema then. So, why can't you sleep on someone's floor? Why can't you hitchhike? You know, but Dutch and I bought plane tickets, and we went out. Dutch went because he was really anxious to see the basic text. He thought he wanted to observe history. It was a very interesting experience. At the time, we met at a union hall in Santa Monica.
The retail clerks union hall.
Yes. Since the conference was getting bigger and was soon to outgrow that space, Steve B, who was then the WSC chair, asked that the alternates not sit at the tables, that they sit in the back in the gallery. Of course, no one paid attention to that, except Larry said to me, "Well, John, you better sit in the back." And then he was nominated for world policy chair. Larry became world policy chair, and I got to actually sitting in the back and not having any duties whatsoever. I was able to, meet a lot of people and, go to meetings and become friends. And I remember I became great friends with a man named Buddy Kay, who is no longer with us and who invited me to stay with him in San Francisco after the conference. And I went up there and spent a couple of weeks and met even more people. So it was a very, for me, it was a very, very productive kind of event if you count the networking. So the next year I was the RSR, and that was the wild and woolly year when Jimmy Kay was locked out of the office. Ron, you've heard me speak on that subject. But I will tell you one, before I explain that, I'll tell you one piece of irony. I was nominated to be world policy chair. I went off the floor, but I trusted my alternate Dutch to do the right thing. So, now I was wrong. That was not the year. That was not the year of the great brouhaha.
Okay, so then by my math, it was 82. You were the alternate. 83. You were the RSR. And that 83 was the year you're talking about where the thing happened with Jimmy. And then 84, you were the policy chair.
Okay. What happened the year of the brawls, first of all, let me make the mandatory disclaimer, is that no one respects Jimmy Kay's contribution to NA more than I do. His vision or his dedication kept NA alive for 20 years when no one was paying any attention to it, but also his limited vision prevented NA from growing. He ran a tight ship. Some might say he was a control freak, and he was suspicious and jealous of outsiders and people he didn't trust and didn't know. When NA began to grow despite this insularity during the 1970s, he was very resistant to new people. The visionary from that period in California was Gray P. And it was Gray P who wrote the tree, the NA tree, our first service structure, who got the World Service Conference going. Who knows what would have happened except that Greg and Jimmy quarreled and Greg moved to the East Coast. And so people from brand new forming regions would keep on showing up in California. And I don't want to say shunned, but they were left out in the cold. So in the early 1980s, for instance, there was no trustee that wasn't from California. And the majority of them were from Southern California. Jimmy had this idea that you needed to live within 50 miles of the World Service Office so you could come to meetings. So there was a lot of distress about that. Also a lot of distress about the attitude coming from the World Service Office was that we'll have a book when Jimmy decides to write the book. And so the idea of Bo taking the bull by the horns and creating these world literature conventions without asking anybody's permission, and at the beginning, almost exclusively an East Coast phenomenon. Now that grew and rolled across the whole country, whatever that means. There are only about 200 meetings that produced the book. So there was a lot of East versus West tension going on at the World Service Conference long before what happened next happened. And that is that we raised, this is a big collective we, the program, World Literature Committee, raised $30,000, largely through sales of special editions of the basic text, raised $30,000 to have the book printed. You know, basic text was and is a self-published book that without bids, without what you and I might consider standard business practice, Jimmy in his capacity as manager of the WSO turned that $30,000 over to a printer who went bankrupt, and that was the end of our $30,000. People were enraged. And that set the scene for money's raised again. The basic text is published. Jimmy, for the first time, deigns to come to the World Service Conference. This is my third World Service Conference. It's the first time I set eyes on him. And Jimmy comes. People get online to ask him to sign the book and all that business. then they go back to wherever they're staying that night. This is the last year at the Union Hall, and they read it, and they discover the famous missing passages. And that's when the manure hits the fan. That's when the conference gets enraged. So there's an explanation. Jimmy didn't give it. Jimmy did not. Jimmy appeared that one day and didn't come back. The explanation given was that Jimmy read the proofs, considered these passages to be completely inappropriate, and consulted with the chair of the Board of Trustees, Chuck S., and with the newly elected chair of the World Service Conference, Bob R., and they agreed, and Jimmy instructed the printer to remove them. And then later on, the entire Board of Trustees agreed with the action, said, yeah, you've done right. This is correct. Interesting sidebar to this is that part of the problem here was a lack of policy of what to do in these situations. I mean, who had the authority to do what? And so that was a secondary effect, a longer term effect of all this was it was the death of the NA tree. People finally agreed that the tree was no longer adequate to, that we had become too complex. The more immediate and more spectacular results were, okay, this was the warm up, asking the then trustees, you know, to have their positions reaffirmed, to get up one by one. And by this point, by the way, Bob R., the WSC chair, had, you know, had repented. and some of the other trustees repented in front of the conference and kept their jobs. And some of the other trustees did not repent, and they were asked to leave the Board of Trustees. And Chuck Skinner refused to go through this, and I'll never forget, he stormed out of the Union Hall, and before he slammed the door, turned around and said, "You'll pay the fucking piper." And then the next thing to happen was to replace Jimmy Kay as, the title then was the manager of the WSO. And overwhelmingly, this is the only time a staff position has ever been hired by the conference. So the conference hires Bob Stone, a non-addict who has been acting as our parliamentarian for a couple of years. They hire Bob Stone as the new manager. And Bob Stone, because of all these volunteers, and, you know, there were dozens of keys to the WSR floating around Southern California, Bob, quite appropriately, under new management, changed the locks, which in this case was the front door and the back door. But that's the story. The conference overwhelmingly voted to hire Bob. If I had to do it over again, I would do it again. I voted for him. You know, so that's that story.
Okay, hey John, let me ask you a question about literature. Did you were there any what you felt were deficiencies in any of the kind of primal literature in the fellowship?
Well, of course. We are extremely lucky that the basic text reads as well as it does because of the way it was written. Books like that, in order to be effective, need to be written with a single voice. Now, to be honest with you, the best way to have something written with a single voice is to have a single author. But if it's going to be the text for a group that involves many, many, many people, you then need to have that revised, tweaked, edited, polished in such a way as to represent the entire group. We did it much differently. And we were quite lucky that somehow the spirit acted as that single voice. And so the basic text reads pretty well in a kind of unified coherency. The part that I would love to see, well, not so much changed, but written differently, were the traditions. The essays are too short. They really weren't subjected to any serious scrutiny. Of course, the problems we've had with the basic text have focused on that section.
Okay, I'm thinking about the reading, What is the Narcotics Anonymous Program? Did you feel it was inclusive enough?
Oh, well, is that a loaded question?
It's a leading question.
A leading question.
Yeah.
Well, gee, Dave, I think it's just fine. There's nothing to say. The white book, the little white book, reflected the vision at the time. It tried to be as inclusive as it could, but it missed some people. And it also, since the original NA members were AA members, it bought into the two disease concept. That is, there are two diseases, alcoholism and a drug addiction, they would say. And to quote Bill W., referring to alcoholics, he allowed that drug addicts were first cousins of a sort and not to be dealt with. Now, what we used to call during the 80s the NA philosophy of recovery. And the Board of Trustees during the 1980s, at its best, functioned as a think tank, developing that thought. What is our philosophy of recovery? Where do we stand? And it became more and more clear, certainly this is one of the clarities of the basic text, that addiction is a disease and drug usage is but a symptom of the disease of addiction, and that alcohol is simply another drug. So to say that I'm an addict is also to say that I'm an alcoholic, and that it's confusing to say both. And so the basic text says that, but the white book doesn't. So in 1985, by this point I'm elected to the Board of Trustees. In 1985, the trustees are enjoined to revise the white booklet to make it consistent with the philosophy of recovery expressed in the basic text. And we did that. And for a while, we worked this way, that Ron H. was now working for the WSO. And he was assigned as an editor liaison to the trustees. I was the trustee with a writing background. And so Ron and I would work on a piece, you know, do the grunt work, and then we would present it to the trustees for the final revisions. Now, the trustees, I don't think we ever actually, didn't talk much about this. It just seemed like what we wanted to do. There are, three or four stories at the end of the white booklet, and we wanted to update those. they use very 1950s junky language, and I remember Sally E. Was particularly insistent on this, that we, that we smooth these out. Go through the booklet and smooth out other language, polish it up a bit, and then it came to the question of the list of people who were who we didn't discriminate against, who were welcome despite. We decided to add sexual identity. Okay, there was a trustee who was adamantly opposed to adding anything regarding sexual identification. She kept on banging her little fist on the table, saying, this has nothing to do with addiction. And I would say in frustration, but this is what it's about. These are the things that don't have any, but it has nothing to do with addiction. And she was part of, you know, the trustees had little factions and blocks, and you know, she was a part of a little voting block that she could count on 3 votes against this, and she kept on pushing. And who knows? The initial idea was to use the word sexuality.
Let me just interject here for a minute. We're talking about the section of the Little White Book where it says, regardless of age, race.
Yes, yes.
And it used to say, regardless of age, race, color, creed, religion, or lack of religion.
Yes.
So the first conversation was color and race was probably a redundancy. So one of those could be removed. And
right.
In place, you were arguing that sexual identity sexuality.
I was arguing for sexuality, and she never actually conceded, but I wore her down. And so she proposed sexual preference.
I remember that.
Which I was horrified by. And she never would have gotten what the objection to sexual preference was, ever. And this was 1985, and so, you know, this was a new thing to move away from sexual preference, because it was not a preference, it's not a choice. And by this point, the trustees are getting impatient, and I'm concerned that they're going to go with sexual preference. And out of the blue, and this was a stroke of inspiration, I said, what about sexual identity? And lo and behold, everyone said, oh, that's great. And that was the end of the discussion. Now, I at the time had no idea of the implications of what I had suggested and what we had just done. And that is that the term sexual identity is larger than homosexuality, larger than lesbianism. It includes a lot of other people. As we know more, the sexual spectrum seems to get bigger all the time. And we understand all these hidden identities that people have. So we were quite in the forefront of that. And so we have a phrase that there's no need to look at and change now. It covers a whole lot of people. And I never quite got the implications of that until Ron, you said to me a few years ago, oh, this is the most important thing you ever did. And so be it.
Yeah, and you know, let me remember just slightly differently. I mean, and that's to be expected. We all remember those things just slightly differently when we're talking about events that happened 30 years ago. But I remember that after there was a basic concession to include this sexuality piece, then the debate began, what is the best way to do it? Is to say, and sexual orientation was another one. And
right, orientation was on the table too.
Yeah. Yes. And basically, at the time, this was all new to me. You know, I'm thinking sexual orientation is right. That makes sense. And you began to argue for sexual identity on the basis at the time that it was more inclusive than whether one is gay or straight. That it was almost like you were saying this with a sense of discovery yourself. But I'm sitting in the room. I'm a mouse in the corner because I'm office staff. I'm not part of the discussion. I'm just taking notes and stuff. But I was really fascinated by that. And I think you were more visionary in that moment than you're giving yourself credit for and remembering, because you made the point that it's going to apply to, you know, to others beside for whom sexual identity is an issue, and it's not just sexual orientation. If it was just about being gay, maybe that word would have been acceptable. I don't know.
Right. You know, it's funny. All I can remember is that beyond sexual orientation or sexuality, those two terms, that were both on the table. And I think you're right. It's probably more, we were veering more towards sexual orientation. Sexual identity was not a term that I'd given any thought of, to. You know, that was not, you know, it just came to me at that moment.
I wonder if you are aware that a few years ago, the Spanish translation of the basic text was challenged by some members because they had not translated that word exactly as it appears in the basic text, which is common with translations. They're not bound to have exact literal translations, but to they're supposed to go for conceptual fidelity to the underlying meaning. But it was challenged on the basis that the conceptual fidelity was not there. I'm not positive what they did call it. Maybe it was orientation or preference. But they actually had a debate within the Spanish-speaking community, had a bit of a controversy about this, and changed it to be conceptual.
Well, I never heard that. That is fascinating.
John, let me ask you, how did the vote go?
Oh,
I gather it was not unanimous.
You know, I can't remember. I cannot remember the vote. Ron might, but I don't.
I don't remember either. I remember the feeling, and the feeling was that this was such a victory, and I think a lot of people felt it in the room, not just that one side had won, but that this is probably the last time that any kind of substantive change is going to be able to be made to this literature at the pace that our fellowship is growing, and we could see what had happened in AA, that their book was sacrosanct. Ours was still pretty new, so the notion of making a change was not yet heretical. And so we knew that we probably were not going to get another shot at this. And to have gotten that one right was a pretty big win.
And not only that, what I think is that here we are 30 years down the pike, and it still stands without any sniping. Just don't hear any criticism about the white booklet. I wish we used it more. I've been in home groups where I suggested, well, if we don't have the money to give every newcomer a basic text, at the very least we should invest in a buck and a quarter and have the white booklet there to give newcomers. Back in the day, they used to call that a hip pocket program.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'll tell you also, I have one of my offspring is trans and is a young, creative proponent of the latest thinking and the latest phrasing and you know, an advocate for more awareness about that issue. And I think there is a lot of change going on around the acceptance of that issue and the recognition that that's still a minority that's often either in the shadows or ridiculed in some way and that sort of stuff. And when I think about that language, sexual identity, and how much that now includes them, that feels very rich. That back in 1986, it might have been 85, it was the 86 conference where it was approved, that the decision made was visionary enough to be inclusive of the whole spectrum today.
And if you recall, it sailed through the conference. There was only one vote against it, and that was the RSR from the Greater Philadelphia region. Where will it end, he said. To which I went over to him later and said, I said, until every goddamn addict is a welcome here.
There you go.
So.
Well,
I don't have any I don't hold grudges.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of how I'm going to, you know, when I set these interviews up in the Recovery Cast, I write a little intro. So the apologia, I'm already planning in the back of my mind about the colorful and opinionated character that we're interviewing here. So,
I never thought of myself as either, but so I'm told.
Yeah, in fact, I can speak as a young, I guess I'm, I don't know if you mind saying how old you are. I just turned 60 this year.
Well, that's because you're a kid. Next week, I'll be 68. January 27th, I'll be 68.
Okay, so I'm at the conference as a 20-something, 20, I guess I was in my late 20s by then, and you were a 30-something, very colorful character, bow tie and you know, PhD. And I mean, this is not the standard fare of who stands up at the mic to make their case. And a lot of really smart people and well-spoken people, but you were different. You were, you know, this very articulate character and opinionated as hell and absolutely fearless about saying whatever you thought. And yet, able to parse an issue with such subtlety and clarity that there were a lot of us sitting there really enjoying the fact that you were in line to get up to the mic and saying, what's he going to say now? But also, what kind of clarity is he about to give us about something that we're debating? So I've always appreciated your role a lot.
Oh, I really appreciate your saying that. At the time, you know, the only feedback you get is negative. A lot of people, I was not popular. And, you know, I'm not going to say that that didn't hurt, but that's what I heard a lot. And then, of course, now this is all faded in time. So, you know, people, we don't, it is an anonymous program. And so I think there are people from that period who made enormous contributions who are almost completely forgotten.
Yeah.
Sally, for instance, who was chair of the trustees when I came.
Just an absolute jewel.
And we lost her a couple of years ago. And James D., who was a real spiritual mentor for me. And Steve B., who is one of the calmest people I know. People like that who really were very instrumental. Their presence was instrumental. You know, people just don't know who they are, which is, you know, that's what happens when you serve an anonymous program. We don't get blue ribbons when we retire.
Yeah. And, you know, something about that is okay. But then there's another piece of that, that we're all human beings. And to feel the appreciation of your fellows, you know, it feels good. So maybe the last thing we really have time to talk about is how the trustees, when you were a member of the trustees, there was really no term limit on the trustees. Early, there was a notion trustee for life. And then there became a notion trustees to get elected periodically, but they didn't have term limits. With the World Board came term limits, a solid 2 terms, you're done. But there was a time when the conversation started to come up that we needed to have trusted servant rotation, and that some of these people who had been trustees for a long time, you know, began to be less likely to be elected. You were on the trustees when that started happening, and people who had really served for a period of time with a lot of distinction were not reelected, and there was just a ton of hurt and difficulty around that. Can you talk about that?
I only say this jokingly. You forget you're talking to the father of the twigs.
Oh, that's right. We won't hold it. We won't hold it against you, John.
Hey, the temporary working guide lasted for 15 years.
Yes, it did. It held the ship together for a long time.
Yes, it did.
The twigs is an acronym for the temporary working guide to the service structure. In the 1980s, NA had a lot of difficulty agreeing on how our services should be structured. There had been a very simplistic service manual in place for a short time, which replaced the TREE, our first service manual. This was a blue-covered booklet simply called the NA Service Manual. It introduced the basic elements of service, which have been in place ever since, the area and the region, and their various subcommittees. We were growing very rapidly at the time, and the sting was still in the air about the language changes in the first edition basic text that John was referring to earlier. The controversy was whether NA World Services was to be considered part of NA. John referred to, quote, the missing passages, unquote, in the first edition, which were two instances of the phrase, quote, all else is not NA, unquote, in the fourth and ninth traditions. They were removed during the initial publication of the first edition, as John described, and were put back in right away by the conference, creating the second edition basic text. Then the conference took up the question of whether the changes should be made through the proper means, a motion at the World Service Conference. And through that process, they were removed again, creating the third edition. So in 1983, when the policy committee of the conference, of which John was chair, attempted to present a more detailed vision of the service structure in the form of a green-covered new edition of the service manual, the local service pieces passed and became policy, but the parts of that booklet describing world services were not passed. As a workaround, the policy committee offered a document called the Temporary Working Guide to the Service Structure, which the conference agreed would be put in place while an ad hoc committee was convened to come up with the final draft that the conference could finally pass, hopefully next year. It turned out that agreement could not be reached in a timely manner, and the twigs stayed in place for 15 years. That ad hoc committee morphed a couple of times over those years and first produced a guide to local service, which was adopted by the conference in the early 90s and replaced the local service parts of the twigs. So the twigs was renamed the Twigwiss. TWGWSS, the Temporary Working Guide to the World Service Structure, covering just the World Service pieces. It wasn't until the major restructuring of World Services occurred in 1998 and the various components of World Services were consolidated into the World Board and the Human Resource Panel, the World Pool, and the positions of conference co-facilitators were created that we finally retired the Twigwiss in favor of the Guide to World Services. This document survives today, though it is modified each two-year conference cycle to reflect any new policies passed by each successive World Service Conference.
The twigs made it very, very clear that a trustee term was 5 years. So you had to be elected every 5 years. So what happened in the late 80s, we started regularly having trustees come up for re-election. And so the concept of rotation in service was floating around. Also, and I think that this is still true, you have to get a two-thirds vote of the conference to be elected to the Board of Trustees.
Actually, in 1998, when the World Board was constituted, the bar was lowered slightly, so that it now takes 60% of the World Service Conference to approve each board member.
So in 1988, three standing trustees were not reelected, and they were shocked. And the following year, I was not reelected. After that, that sort of died down because later on, other trustees were reelected. At the time, I was disappointed. There was an adjustment period, a serious adjustment period, because this had been a significant portion of my life. I was vice chair of the board, which meant I also had to attend WSO board meetings. I was on the board of the Convention Corporation. So there was this great void in my life that I had to fill in with life, but that was easy enough. 6 months down the pike, I was over it. So I look back on my almost 10 years at World Service as this enormous opportunity that we were all given to affect thousands of people in the future. We made decisions and developed policies and wrote literature that has made the world a better place and has made the program a better place. And so I'm grateful for that.